This is going to seem like a strange story to lead off with tonight, especially with all the things that are going on in the news, locally, nationally, the controversies, the political machinations, the Supreme Court vacancy, repercussions of which are probably going to echo for decades to come. What I want to talk about right at the top of the show is the urgent question being asked by some of the faithful. Is God male? Is God a man? Now, this isn't something I'm personally curious about or unclear on. I'm pretty locked down on my opinion on this, but apparently it's the topic of some rather elaborate deliberation amongst the Episcopal Church. And I want to get into it here, not because we've suddenly become Christian Talk Radio here on Twin Cities News Talk, but because I think it's endemic or indicative is the word I'm looking for of one of the underlying vulnerabilities in our culture right now. One of the reasons why we find ourselves facing such maddening challenges to reality itself in our political discourse, our public discourse. Closing argument. My name's Walter Etzen. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. You never have to miss a beat, guys. It's a great little device. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Brianne in with us tonight to take us into your 4th of July weekend. Brad's out at a concert tonight.
Oh, Brad.
You know, little trivia about yours truly. Never been to a music concert.
Stop.
Of any kind ever. Well, actually, that's not true.
On principle?
No, I'm just a nerd. Years ago, it just so happens, I think this is something else I've never disclosed on the program before. I used to intern across the hall here at KDWB. Now, it wasn't actually literally across the hall because at the time they were in a different building downtown. And while I was an intern for a guy named Tony Fly, who's still out and about doing things in the city.
He's around.
We did something called the Last Chance Summer Dance. I don't know if you recall this is a thing KDWB used to do.
And so
I worked at that. And I worked at similar concerts that they were putting on for the station. But there's a difference between I'm doing intern where you know this. There's a difference between working an event.
I'm very skilled in this, yes.
And going to an event.
Saying. Yes.
Right. So I don't think it counts.
Doesn't count. Nope.
So,
well, you have to go and do that. Enjoy one day.
Yeah, that's what Brad said as well. That's what Brad said as well. So, and my wife would be more than thrilled to jump in on that. Of course, if I let her pick it out, it's probably going to be something that I might not be all that enthusiastic about. All right. So, turning to CBN, which I believe stands for the Christian Broadcast Network, they're covering this story about a debate within the Episcopal Church over the gender of Almighty God. Since before the days of the early church, God has always been addressed in prayers as a male, including terms like Father, King, and Lord. In the New Testament, Jesus taught his disciples to pray to God using a male term. In Luke 11, 1 through 4, one of the disciples asked Jesus to teach them how to pray. And he said to them, when you pray, say, Father, hallowed be your name. Now, in the Episcopal Church, they're debating about overhauling its Book of Common Prayer, which is used in Episcopal congregations worldwide. The debate centers on making sure that prayers in the book are clear that God is not male, but doesn't have a gender, the Washington Post reports. As long as, now here's the rationale. Are you guys ready for this? Put your seatbelts on. As long as men and God are in the same category, our work toward equity will not be complete. They got a little bit of a typo here. I honestly think it won't matter in some ways. The Reverend Will Gaffney, a professor of the Hebrew Bible at Britt Divinity School in Texas, told the newspaper. Gaffney is on the committee recommending a change to the gendered language in the prayer book. Like many other Episcopal priests, he wants a prayer book that upholds that God is bigger than any gender. The stupid is strong with this one. This is so utterly dumb.
Don't we have other things to worry about?
We do. We do have other things to worry about.
Not in the context of you, but I just can't believe we're kind of here at this
point. No, I know. I understand. I just, you know, they answer their own question, right? When he says God is bigger than any gender, okay, so where are you getting this premise of men being put on the level of God because God is referred to as a him? Like, where was that implied? If you actually read that book, if you actually read the Bible, it's extraordinarily clear in very harsh and dramatic and conclusive language that God is not on the level of you, regardless of what you're packing, right? Like, regardless of what equipment you claim, you are not on the level of God. And God will be the first one to tell you that enthusiastically, that you are not on his level. So where are they gathering this notion that to call God, to refer to God in the masculine, is to place men on the same level as God? It's intentional stupidity. Like, you have to try to be that dumb.
It's definitely reaching.
And yet, this is indicative of the kind of cognitive, I don't even want to use the word confusion, because confusion can be innocent, right? Like, you can be confused and it not be your fault. This is their fault. This is them choosing to be dumb. This is a willful, not even ignorance, because they do know. Like, they know this is stupid. They know they're being too cute by half. They're choosing to conflate simple, obvious theological meanings to the detriment of their congregation, to the detriment of believers who are taking them seriously and scratching their heads and going, gee, I never thought about that before. What if God is gender neutral? Or what are the implications of that? Complete and utter nonsense. And it's a rejection of objective reality. And yes, I understand I'm talking about the context of religion here, right? So, you know, religion is subjective, but it's not. It's really not. When you think about the object of what religion is, we're going to go off in the weeds a little bit here theologically. I personally have never understood the concept of having a religious affiliation that's just something that you dip your toes into once in a while. Something that, you know, you claim as like, you know, the same way you would, oh, I'm a fan of a show, right? I watch Game of Thrones. Oh, by the way, I also go to church on Sunday. Just a couple of odd things about me, little quirks, little things that I do. Like, to me, the whole point of having a religious affiliation, a religious identity, is because you actually subscribe, you've thoughtfully considered and willfully subscribe to the tenets of a faith. And if that's the case, in a religious context, out of necessity, You are yielding, you're conceding the idea, the concept that there's a greater reality than that which you can perceive, to which you are accountable. And if that's your premise, then you cannot try to shoehorn that greater reality into your worldview, your perceptions, your understanding of how things work. And that's what this is. Let's make God gender neutral. So that we can make better, so that our world, our conclusions about the world we live in that we've already made, not so that we can sit at the feet of this hypothetical gender neutral God and hear the wisdom dispensed from its mouth, right? Because we can't call it him, can't call it her. Not for the purpose of growing closer to God or understanding God better or having a greater consideration of his word. Has nothing to do with that. It's so that we can be more comfortable with what we already believe about the world we live in and not have to deal with what we're confronted with in the Bible. And look, that's your right. Like, I'm not interested in trying to push religion on anybody. I just don't understand where you're coming from if this is your approach. Like, if you've got problems with what the Bible says, if you've got problems with what Jesus said, then don't subscribe to it. Like, don't call yourself a Christian. What's the point in trying to rewrite what's been written and trying to reinterpret what's been interpreted and trying to shape it into something that it's not in order to make you more comfortable? At that point, it's not really a religious exercise anymore, is it? At that point, it's a type of social activism, and that's what's at the root of this. It's trying to co-opt the authority of the Almighty to push your social agenda about gender neutrality and gender fluidity and sexual orientation and a dozen other things having to do with what junk people are claiming, right? And it's really atrocious. To try to hijack people's most sacred beliefs, you know, to look at something that has been established through tradition and faithfully reproduced text for thousands of years and decide arbitrarily that you're going to not discover that it actually means something else, but to simply just call it something different arbitrarily in order to affect your own purpose. That takes a type of audacity that really is beyond the pale. You know, the sense that what I believe is so important that it needs to displace and overthrow established doctrine going back thousands of years. But of course, we shouldn't be surprised by that at all, right? Because this is the essential nature of the modern left. It's insurgent. It's about displacing tradition. It's about overthrowing normalcy. It's about conflating truth with fiction to a revolutionary end in order to make up down and down up and good bad and bad good so that there is no morality anymore. There is no sense of right and wrong anymore. And we all have to turn to the almighty state, the golden calf we've constructed, in order to get our marching orders going forward. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Fear. Last night, we spent some time going through this walk away movement, hashtag walk away on Twitter, that has kind of exploded over the weekend, arising out of a video that was posted just over a month ago by a gentleman by the name of Brandon Straka, or Straka, I believe it is, gay hairdresser, who put out this video declaring that he used to be a leftist, he used to be a liberal, he voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, he's been a Democrat, you know, all of his life, but he's had enough. He's walking away. And he provided his reasons. We played the audio from it last night. Reasons that you can quite readily imagine, and you are probably correct, in terms of the false promises, the victimization, the advocacy for violence, all the same reasons why you and I are not leftists. But people are waking up to this, who have been following the Democrats and voting for Democrats for a number of years. And it's facilitating this walk away movement. And continuing along that theme tonight, I wanted to continue our analysis of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has just secured a primary victory over the number 4 ranking Democrat in Congress. Crowley is the guy's name. He's out now, part of the Democratic establishment, Joe Crowley. And you know, this 28-year-old millennial who is part of the Democratic Socialist Society and believes in such things as Medicare for All, which is just another way of saying universal health care, government funded total control of your ability to seek care when you're sick and injured. She wants to control that completely. Free college tuition basically rolling higher education into the public education system and paying for it somehow, some way, with money taken from you, taken out of the economy. She believes in that. And she also believes in a federal jobs guarantee that, you know, forget about economic reality. Forget about the supply and demand that emerges in a market that actually signals to actors whether or not they ought to produce a certain thing, whether or not they ought to purchase a certain thing. We're just going to skip all that, forgo all that, and assign a committee to the task of ensuring that every single human being within the jurisdiction of the United States has a job. Yeah, that's going to work out great. Look, they may in fact end up giving everybody a quote job unquote, but it's not going to be one that produces economic value. And so this is nothing but redistribution. This is the direction that the Democratic Party is apparently going. Now, we've been going back and forth on that point on the past few days on whether or not the victory of Ocasio-Cortez over Joe Crowley is indicative of an overall ideological shift within the party. Because, you know, just looking at the district itself in question and considering our analysis from Daniel Greenfield over at Front Page Mag that we considered last night, this is a district where Joe Crowley was not going to survive long term just because of the changes that have taken place with redistricting and demographic shifts going forward. He was going to lose to somebody. It just so happened that he lost to Ocasio-Cortez. And so, you know, the question of whether or not this signals some sort of massive sea change for the direction of the Democratic Party as a whole is one that lacks a sort of substantive analytical justification. But swinging out of nowhere, flying out of left field to undermine that analysis is the DNC chair, as reported by The Hill. Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents the future of our party on Tuesday. I have three kids. Two of them are daughters. One just graduated college, one who is in college, and they are both texting me about their excitement over Alexandria because she represents the future of our party, Perez said on the Bill Press show. Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old self-proclaimed Democratic socialist and organizer with Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, rose to fame after defeating incumbent Representative Joe Crowley in a stunning primary upset last week. So there you go. From the horse's mouth, from the lead horse, Tom Perez, DNC chairman, Ocasio-Cortez, believer in federal jobs guarantees and universal health care, is the future of the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, you know, what I find interesting and relevant to the whole walk away thing is there's this battle that has emerged in the past couple of days in terms of narrative of how we ought to think of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she's portrayed herself as the girl from the Bronx, you know, somebody who comes from a working class, underprivileged background and has, you know, through against all odds, ascended to this position of prominence and potentially being a congresswoman representing a district of New York. From the Star Tribune, rising political star Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has often talked about her working class roots in New York City's Bronx, saying in a campaign video alongside gritty street images, "I was born in a place where your zip code determines your destiny." But in the days following the Democrats' stunning primary victory over 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley, she's been forced to defend that campaign narrative against conservative critics who have seized on reports that she spent much of her life growing up, not in the Bronx, but 35 miles north on a quiet suburban street in Westchester County. Ocasio-Cortez's mother, Bianca, told the New York Times that her daughter was about 5 years old when the family moved from the Bronx, where she was born, to a modest home in Yorktown, New York. That property records show her father purchased a few years before for $150,000. Ocasio-Cortez's campaign said that the move was made to allow her to attend better schools and that she moved back to the Bronx after graduating from college. John Cardillo, who hosts America Talk Live on the Newsmax cable channel, sent a tweet Sunday showing a photo of Ocasio-Cortez's childhood home with the caption, "This is the Yorktown Heights, very nice area home Ocasio grew up in before going off to Ivy League Brown University." And Ocasio-Cortez fought back, you know, and she's trying to make the case that, no, my poor bona fides are legit. Now, I can relate to this in a couple of different ways. One, being a minority myself. And two, I could pull this trick if I really wanted to. I could do exactly what Ocasio-Cortez is doing. Because I was born in Detroit, Michigan. I was born there. And I lived in the immediate suburbs of Detroit until I was about 12 years old. And then my family up and moved to Minnesota, to Cottage Grove. So I could portray myself if I really wanted to as, you know, somebody who came from the street. And let me tell you, because this is true. This is absolutely true. I went back a few years ago to the street that my first house that I ever lived in is on in Inkster, Michigan. And had I not grown up there, I would not have stopped the car. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was not the type of place where you would feel comfortable stopping and getting out of the car. Now, I did because, you know, I walked around those streets when I was five, so I figured it was probably okay. And as it turns out, here I am, didn't get stabbed, didn't get shot. But I'm just saying, it wasn't a nice neighborhood. But to try to portray, to try to take that childhood experience and portray it as somehow being defining of my character and indicative of the way I grew up, and the values that I was instilled with, would be a total lie. It would be a complete fabrication. I am a kid from Cottage Grove, Minnesota. And Cottage Grove, Minnesota is, I don't know, maybe it isn't anymore, but at the time I was there, pretty darn white. Pretty darn Caucasian out there in the Grove. Right?
I was just there and I confirmed those reports. Yes. Yeah. Still just like that.
So, you know, that's my background. And so for me to try to portray myself as being, you know, a minority from the block, you know, from the street, who had it rough, that would be a lie. And it seems like Ocasio-Cortez is trying to pull that same trick. Now, what I find interesting about this from the walk away perspective is it demonstrates both the fact that conservatives see the opportunity to call her out and that she feels the need to defend the narrative that she's put out there. What it clearly indicates is that there's value within the Democratic ecosphere. There's value in being underprivileged.
It's a currency.
Right. There's political currency in being oppressed. And this is foundational to what Walk Away is all about. The left is rooted in the culture of grievance. We've talked about this at length, and it'll continue to be a theme of the show for as long as we're on the air. The left is rooted in the culture of grievance, and the culture of grievance is one wherein your credibility is established by your level of oppression. The more oppressed you are, the more underprivileged you are, the less you've achieved, the less success you've enjoyed, the more moral authority you are granted by your leftist brethren. And so, to be successful, and we saw this here in Minnesota in CD2. Angie Craig has been dealing with it in terms of her effort to try to challenge Jason Lewis once again this year. She's come under fire as being, you know, a corporate shill because she held an executive position at a healthcare company. Like, in a sane world, you would call that experience, right? You would call that qualification something that you would actually want in a candidate to hold public office, somebody who has some experience dealing with the real world. But in the left, that's, oh, you're part of the problem. You're part of the machine because you actually have done something with your life.
Well, it's oppressed versus oppressor. I mean, that's communism 101.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, another revealing aspect of what we're dealing with here coming out of the Ocasio-Cortez campaign. We'll talk with Leland from Minneapolis when we return, 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I want to get to Leland from Minneapolis. He's been holding for a while. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Leland, welcome to the program.
Oh, hey, Walter. How's it going?
Good.
You are so right about the blatant, purposeful stupidity of having to explain God the Father as versus to man being a father. I just had pizza tonight. I love pizza, but I don't have to explain to no one that me loving my child and me loving pizza is totally two different things.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the scene in Trading Places where Ralph Bellamy's explaining commodities to Eddie Murphy. Uh-huh. And he's like, and this is bacon, as you would find in a bacon and lettuce and tea sandwich. And Eddie Murphy kind of looks at the screen like, really? You needed to explain that to me?
Right.
You know, other than man giving his essence to create life, which that's what they're kind of comparing it to. And, you know, maybe he's supposed to, you know, like instruct his family, but a lot of people aren't that way. And sometimes the fatherly influence may be the mom, because she has that strong sort of a parental sort of thing.
Right.
It's like, you know, a lesbian couple, one might have that sort of thing because of the way she was brought up. But the essence of man, I mean, it's only as far as it goes, because the essence of God created a far-flung universe totally on a totally different level.
Yeah, this is a projection of the left's own insecurities about gender differences. You know, it's you have to, like, you before you can come to the conclusion that we need to retcon the Bible to make God some genderless thing that doesn't exist. But before you can get to that point, you have to have first already concluded that there's inherent lesser value in females as compared to males. Because if you don't, if you haven't already concluded that, then there's no problem with God being a male, right? Like the only way that's a problem is if you believe that that either imbues men with some sort of higher status, or that God somehow chose men or chose to be male as an affront to women, which there's absolutely zero basis for coming to that conclusion biblically whatsoever.
Right.
Appreciate the call, Leland.
Yep.
Yeah, it's truly mind-blowing. You know, this gender stuff, biblically, you know, not to get too deep into theology here tonight, but this idea of there being suppression of women in the Bible and there being suppression of women in Christianity and Judaism, nothing could be further from the truth. Historically, you know, if you engage in an intellectually honest search for truth throughout history, nowhere has there been a greater value of women than under the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's the reason why women have the status in modern Western society today that they do, is because of the ideas that were introduced through the Judeo-Christian tradition regarding the equality of women, their equal value, their equal worth. You know, you go back to stories of the disciples interacting with the female followers of Christ and with Jesus Christ himself, and the care and value that Jesus gave to his female followers, and the rebuke that he gave to his disciples when they tried to dismiss the women amongst them. It's pretty obvious where God stands on the value of women and the question of women. You know, going back to Abraham, he rebuked Abraham for dismissing Sarah. Now, that's a story that every husband can see himself in. You know, here's Abraham. Oh, the missus is going on and on and on about this, that, and the other thing. Telling me my business, telling me what I ought to do. And God says, yeah, well, you should listen to her, because turns out she knows what she's talking about, right? Does that sound like somebody who's trying to put women down, trying to put women in their place? No. The idea, the biblical notion of a wife being a helper to her husband is not a submissive role. It's a complementary one. It's a model, it's an image of the relationship within the Trinity itself, which, you know, is an equal one, right? It's the equal persons of God in a Trinity coexisting, working together in concert, in harmony. That's what marriage and the family is meant to symbolize, the relationship between the mother, the father, the children, working in unison towards common goal, in claiming dominion over creation. All right, enough of the theological seminary talk here for one night. Let's move on to some news. So we were talking about the walk away movement. And as I've been reflecting about it over the past 24 hours, the issue that I've been focused on is just the fundamental nature of the left and why it is that they have this culture of grievance and what that culture of grievance manifests as. And, you know, taken to its furthest extreme, it manifests as violence. And this is inevitable. Like, it will happen if you allow the poisonous ideological ideas of the left to fester and germinate and grow. It will inevitably lead to violence. And it makes sense why it would. Because if your premise is you are oppressed, you are being held back, you have been taken advantage of by, you know, the proletariat or the bourgeoisie, whatever. You know, you've been taken advantage of by the oppressor, by some class, the rich, the white people, men, cisnormative people, whatever the case may be. Somebody's been oppressing you. And so long as that oppression remains in place, you are never going to actualize. You are never going to progress. You are never going to be anything of any worth until you overthrow these shackles. Then that becomes a justification for victory by any means necessary. And it's interesting. You know, I can't go into the details. I'm sworn to secrecy. But let's just say that I'm privy to conversations that are taking place in a bipartisan manner between Republicans and Democrats, where in exploration of these recent stories that have come out, where, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders gets kicked out of a restaurant, this gal down in Florida, I believe she's the attorney general or some similar executive office, got heckled out of a showing of Won't You Be My Neighbor, a documentary about Mr. Rogers. Now, isn't that incredibly ironic? You're going to a movie to see Mr. Rogers, whose whole deal was happiness and neighborliness and Won't You Be My Neighbor, and the answer of the left is, hell no! Get out of here! You're not welcome!
Forget that.
I wonder what Fred Rogers would be saying if he were alive today.
I think his head would explode.
In response to the current condition of the left. But at any rate, these incidents, the question was put forward from a Republican friend to some Democrat friends of, what do you guys think about this? What's your reaction to this? Do you think this is okay? And the response from the Democrat friends was, yeah, I'm fine with it. The spectrum went from, I'm totally fine with it because, and their justification was, look, the things that we're fighting from the Trump administration and from Republicans right now are of such importance that it's not a blip on my radar whether or not Sarah Huckabee Sanders can get a dinner, right?
That's really telling, too.
It's very telling,
I would say.
And then the other end of the spectrum is to go further in justifying and saying, look, this is a legitimate form of civil disobedience. If you feel as though your society has reached a point where revolutionary action is called for, then I would say disrupting somebody during their dinner or disrupting somebody at a movie theater is the least you could do to actually engage in some kind of revolutionary action, you know, short of taking it a step further and being even more violent. But of course, why stop there, right? Like, here's the question that you need to consider. If we truly are under a set of circumstances, you know, put yourself in the leftist's shoes right now. If you truly find yourself in a set of circumstances where it's justifiable to harass and assault people with whom you disagree, then why should you stop at just harassing them? Why should you stop at just assaulting them? If they truly are the threat, the massive existential threat that you perceive them to be, then why should you allow them to continue to exist? And the answer is, there is no limiting principle. There is no restraint other than, I don't want to get caught and I don't want to deal with the consequences of taking it to that level. That's really your only reason for not doing it, is that you don't want to face the consequences. And that's where the left is at. There's a number of stories here. We don't have time to get into them all. But in Lincoln, Nebraska, vandals threw a brick through the window of the Nebraska Republican Party's headquarters. Republican staffers found a spray-painted message beneath the broken window, abolish ICE, right? Alan Dershowitz has a piece in the New York Times talking about how he's being shunned amongst his friends because, you know, he's not a massive Trump supporter, but he's made the case that, you know, here's his revolutionary case. Conservatives, Republicans, Donald Trump, all of the above have civil liberties. That's the audacious case he's been making. And he's losing friends over it. Because it's no longer okay. And we see this with the ACLU. The ACLU, which cut its teeth in a free speech case defending the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois, under the principle that no matter how reprehensible the speech, it ought to be protected under the law, who in 2018 has reversed course and said, we're going to be selective about whose rights we protect. Because certain speech is actually harmful. This goes hand in hand with the New York Times piece recently that was cited by Ben Shapiro, wherein they make the case against the First Amendment out in the open that we need to have limitations on free speech because it's been, quote, weaponized, unquote, by the right. This is the direction the left is going, and it is a path toward violence. And there is no limiting principle on how far down the path they will go. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sean.
I've never been a big fan of Twitter. You know, back in the 140 character days, I just didn't feel as though that was enough to be able to express anything of significance. But since they upped it, my interest has peaked. And in recent days, I found myself paying a lot more attention to the platform, and I've been doing so over the break. And, you know, an unconventional figure who is actually taking quite a beating on Twitter right now from social justice warriors and needs people to come to his defense, William Shatner. Captain Kirk himself, which I kind of want to tell him, dude, just put your phone down.
It's quite the pot stir.
Just put your phone down, man, because, you know, it's not worth it. You're not getting anything out of this. This isn't working for you. I mean, not to say that anything he's doing is wrong, but why would you want to engage with all these trolls, especially with the name ID? You know, everybody trying to get their moment in the sun, in the cyber sun of, look at me, I'm going after William Shatner.
That's what it's become.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's, anyway, you know, if you're out there on the platform, send Shat some love because he needs it. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Actually, you know, I might get an opportunity here. He's coming to town. In the next few weeks, there's going to be a showing of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and he's going to do some commentary afterwards. And I might get the opportunity to go to that. And I think I have to do it.
I think you do.
Just because, I mean, you know, I don't want to be morbid, but the guy's probably not going to be around much longer.
At least not forever.
It might be the last opportunity I get to ever see the guy in person. So, and that would be a good time. You know, and he's always fun. He's always got it. The one thing about Shatner that I've always felt, you know, kind of sad about is whenever I see him, like I've watched a lot of documentaries that he's been in and that he's made. He's not a religious guy. He doesn't have any hope for what comes after. And he's dreadful of death. He's so afraid of dying.
Aww.
And he's very, you know, because he's an artsy-fartsy character, he's very open about it.
Sure.
And it's just depressing to see somebody who's so, like looking into the abyss with such dread.
Right.
And, you know, you wish that he would find something, you know, to latch on to give him some
hope. There's still hope.
There is still hope. There's always hope. All right. So I wanted to touch upon here real quick. From Politico, the Trump administration on Tuesday scrapped Obama-era guidance on race-based admissions policies, just as conservatives see a fresh opening to end affirmative action through a changing Supreme Court. The move comes as a closely watched court battle over Harvard's admissions policies, which has emerged as the next front in the fight over race-based admissions, heats up. Civil rights groups see the Trump administration's decision as part of a larger effort to scrap affirmative action, which has been upheld repeatedly by the Supreme Court, though that could change with the appointment of a new justice soon to be picked by President Donald Trump. The Justice Department announced it was eliminating 24 federal guideline documents that it deemed unnecessary, outdated, inconsistent with existing law, or otherwise improper. Seven of those documents, issued jointly with the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights under the Obama administration, called on school superintendents and colleges to consider race when trying to diversify their campuses. Universities, however, were already vowing to stick with their admissions policies despite the Trump administration reversal. Four decades of case law make clear that race and ethnicity can be one of many factors that universities can consider during the admissions process, said Peter McPherson, president of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, in a statement. Public universities will continue to operate in accordance with the Constitution, state law, and past court rulings to ensure they appropriately foster a diverse campus to the benefit of all. Now, okay, great. So what's the problem then, right? Like, if you're going to do it, whether the administration tells you to or not, then why are we supposed to wring hands and lose sleep over the fact that the administration's doing it? And I have other questions about this, and maybe we can get into it after the break. What somebody needs to explain to me what the inherent value in diversity is. And I think it's okay for me to ask this question because I'm a living, I'm a diverse being. I'm a living manifestation of diversity, right? Black dad, white mom, multiracial kids. I am diversity.
With
right?
A day job and a radio show.
Yeah, all sorts of, like 12 different degrees of diverse. This guy right here. So I'm familiar with the concept, but you still have to explain to me, because I don't innately know, what is the value in it inherently? Why do we need to chase after diversity as such, and with such fervor, you know, as if we're going to lose something if we don't have it? TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Broadcasting on AM.
I'm serious about this. I want to know what the inherent value of diversity is. You know, when we talk about the potential of affirmative action coming to an end, if not through the executive actions of the Trump administration, through a future Supreme Court action under a newly minted conservative majority in the court under Donald Trump. Either way, affirmative action is trumpeted as this necessary device through which we're going to achieve this, what we're supposed to understand to be inherently precious diversity, something which we simply must have, that has such incredible value. Why? What? Going to college. Why do I need to do so with people who look different than me? Or people who hold different religions than I do? Or people from hail who different backgrounds? Like, what is it? What's the value that I'm obtaining through doing that? Now, you can make the argument that it enriches your educational experience, being exposed to different cultures, being exposed to different perspectives and different ideas. And that would be a legitimate argument, but I don't think that's actually the argument that's being employed here. Because if that's an actual value, which I think we can all agree it is, right? Like, being exposed to new ideas, being exposed to new cultures is something that has an inherent educational value. If you recognize that as an educational value, then you can, and rationally will, seek it. You will want it. You will pursue it. And you will obtain it, because it ain't that hard, right? Especially nowadays, with as connected as our world is, if you want to be exposed to different cultures and different ideas and different people, you don't got to go very far. So why does it need to be forced? Why does it need to be public policy? This is what I don't understand. And, you know, I'm being a little bit coy. I do understand it. I understand what their intention is. It's just that when they portray it as this sort of inherent value, that's the part that they need to actually explain to me. What's your argument for why it's valuable? And their answer, you know, when you probe it deeply enough, their answer is eventually going to be that while there's been all this systemic oppression historically against minorities, and so we need to make sure that we put a thumb on the scale of justice to ensure that people of color can get into these institutions in order to benefit. Well, if that's your case, then I guess it doesn't really have any inherent value for the majority then, right? Like when you try to make the case that, well, it's good for all the students for us to do this. Well, it either is or it isn't. And if it is, then you're not going to have to force it because it actually is good for them. And if it's not good for all the students, if you're actually excluding some in order to include others arbitrarily for reasons that have nothing to do with merit, then that's a different story that we need to acknowledge. Closing argument. My name is Walter Adson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. 651-989-5855 is the number to do so, to contribute to the program. Breanne taking those calls and producing the show this evening for us. Boy, I'll tell you what. You think the immigration drama here in the United States is hot and heavy? You think the separation of children from their parents is a controversial issue? You think border controls and abolishing ICE is a controversial situation that we have for ourselves here domestically? We don't hold a candle to what's going on in Germany right now and the European Union. It is off the chain.
Want a little preview? Yeah, look at Europe.
I don't typically pay a whole lot of attention to European politics because I just generally don't care. I'm not vested in it. I'm not particularly interested in what happens in Europe. But for whatever reason, I was attracted to this story out of the New York Times, Germany's Europe-shaking political crisis over immigrants. And it's astounding when you get into the details of what's happening over there from the New York Times. The near political breakdown in Germany marks the beginning of the end for the European experiment, for an era of openness toward refugees and migrants in the West, and for Angela Merkel, the German chancellor at the center of the European political establishment. Or, perhaps, it is a close call in which Ms. Merkel's made difficult sacrifices to hold it all together, as she has done many times before. Or, maybe something in between. The stakes of what is happening in Germany are difficult to overstate, but it can be easy to lose track of how this came to pass and how to think about what could come next. What follows is a simple guide. Why are German politics melting down? It started with a political uprising by Horst Seehofer, Ms. Merkel's interior minister over immigration. He and Ms. Merkel split over secondary migrants, those who entered the European Union in a country such as Italy or Greece, and who then travel across the Union's open borders into Germany. So this would be analogous, if we were going to compare this to the United States, this would be like, say, Iowa complaining about immigrants crossing the border into Arizona and then making their way up to Iowa. That's what's going on here, where the German people are upset about immigrants coming to Italy and Greece and being admitted and then being able to cross the open borders between European Union nations and ending up in Germany. Mr. Seehofer has lots of leverage because he, like Ms. Merkel, leads his own political party. Ms. Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Union, does not operate in Bavaria, a large region sometimes described as the Texas of Germany, because of its affluent areas and conservatism. Instead, Bavaria is dominated by Mr. Seehofer's party, the Christian Social Union. Their parties have split on the immigration issue for a few reasons. Ms. Merkel has stated has staked her legacy on upholding the European Union. A core tenet of the bloc is to maintain open borders among member states. She has also emphasized German leadership on accepting migrants and refugees. But Mr. Seehofer's party, like Bavaria, leans conservative. Its location on the border with Austria means it receives a disproportionate number of secondary migrants. Though new arrivals to Germany and Europe have dropped off almost entirely, a backlash against immigration has brought support to nativist groups. Mr. Seehofer's party is worried about losing ground to the far right, especially ahead of state elections in October. So, Mr. Seehofer demanded that Ms. Merkel close Germany's border to secondary migrants. If she refused, he said, he might do so himself or he might resign, potentially collapsing Germany's governing coalition and maybe even ending Ms. Merkel's 13-year reign. Has the German migrant fight been resolved? Maybe, but probably not. Late Monday, Ms. Merkel announced a compromise deal. Germany would set up camps along the Austrian border to house secondary migrants while their status was reviewed. Any arrival found to have registered for temporary status in a different European Union country, such as Italy, Greece, or Spain, would be deported to that country. So this is, again, comparing this to the United States, because, you know, the European Union, you know, it's not directly analogous because you're dealing with sovereign nations who have this joint agreement between them. Whereas the United States, you know, the states theoretically are sovereign, but it's much more of a marble cake federalism here in the United States. But this would be like if, again, you know, if Iowa was upset about immigrants making their way to Iowa from Arizona and Texas and what have you, other border states, and they set up a policy of having camps at the state line around Iowa to catch and hold immigrants who arrived in the country via Arizona. And their policy was to send the immigrants not back to Mexico, but back to Arizona. I mean, this is nuts. And it's unsustainable, right? Like, just like the logistics of it, you can't both have, and the article goes into this when you, as you continue to read it, you can't simultaneously have open borders between nations and stop everybody to check the immigration status. Like, inherently, definitionally, that's not open borders. So what's at stake here is effectively whether or not the European Union is going to continue to be a thing. And for some folks, you know, that it might be good to see the union collapse. Personally, I have no stake in it. I'm not particularly vested one way or the other in whether or not the European Union continues to be a thing. But it is particularly interesting. I mean, for all the talk of a second American Civil War and polarization and demonization that takes place over our immigration battles here in the United States, we haven't yet got to the point where one state is trying to deport their immigrants to another or trying to shut down their borders from neighboring states. Let's talk to Michael in Apple Valley. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Walter.
Yep.
I've watched that situation over there. I think some of the nations over there have a very hardline policy as to who they're letting into the country. And
yeah,
wasn't that, when Gaddafi was still around, wasn't that his bargaining chip with Europe, that he was basically kind of the gateway that would hold that group of people from coming into Europe? I believe I read, I think it was the gentleman that was actually the head contractor for Blackwater that was talking about that. And once Gaddafi fell, I believe that's when you started to see this huge exodus of people coming into Europe. Like, I have a couple questions. One is, what kind of calculation would Europe make if you're going to take basically a huge influx of third world people?
Mm-hmm.
How is that going to help your society and your economic standing, especially in like Germany and some of those more developed Western?
Yeah, I'm not very well versed in the European situation. I don't know through what mechanism these migrants are making their way to Europe. I suspect, and it sounds like they're being brought there through some sort of governmental or, you know, non-governmental, but, you know, kind of incestuous, you know how it is with non-governmental organizations, they get their funding through the state, that they're being shipped in. And if that's what's taking place, then, you know, I understand the angst. I don't know, that's the thing, is for the third world populace or the infusion of third world immigrants argument to actually hold water, the only circumstance under which that can occur is if it's being somehow subsidized. Because as it turns out, people who live in genuine third world conditions don't have the means to immigrate to Europe or to the United States or to anywhere at all, to the next town over, because they're extraordinarily poor. You know, it's only when you have government policies that intervene in the natural market forces that you see this type of large mass migration of people who would not otherwise have the means onto themselves.
And let me ask you this question. This kind of pertains to the hashtag walk away, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, but I'd routinely watch people like Dinesh D'Souza going to universities. There was a couple years back, I don't know if you know who Paul McGinley is from Chicago, and he talks about Cook County and how the Democratic Party has basically kind of taken, forsaken kind of the black community and not been good for the black family. So we've seen this, I guess, this face of the Democratic Party. Now we know there's hysteria with Trump's success. And so this Ocasio, I believe, comes along and it's like, oh, this is our chance. And I think their strategy now is to create as much turmoil and try to get momentum to carry these into the midterms. But what I was going to ask you is, if this doesn't work, and this is how far you're going to go, I mean, what's the next stop for the Democrats? And the last thing I'll say is, I noticed Schumer hasn't really, he hasn't stepped in and endorsed this Ocasio person.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of between a rock and a hard place, because he's stuck in between. You know, the rock is the institutional reality that this style of politics is not going to bode well for the party nationally. It, what works well in the 17th district of New York is not going to work well in the 2nd district of Minnesota, right?
Agreed.
And so, you know, he's stuck between that rock and the hard place of a grassroots party base that's hard left, rabid, and calling for blood, sometimes quite literally. And that's the answer to your other question of where does the Democratic Party go from here? Look, for them to have ratcheted up their rhetoric and their violence to the degree that they have at this point, if they don't make huge gains this year, which I don't think they will, and certainly if Trump wins again in 2020, which, you know, is a real possibility, I think you're going to start seeing outbreaks of severe violence above and beyond what we've already seen. Because, again, there's no... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just wonder, if wouldn't a better strategy be to have someone of prominence and who's recognized both in the left and on the right to come in and offer an olive branch and say, you know, this is not the way. We really need to have a better dialogue instead of resorting to this.
Well, I think this guy, Brandon Straka, who's doing this walk away thing, he might be that guy in the sense of saying, look, those of us within the Democratic Party and who have called ourselves liberals for years, for most of our lives, if not all of our lives, who recognize what's going on here and realize that it's unsustainable and that it leads us into a very dark place. We need to walk away from this status quo and join the rest of the country in reestablishing a sense of normalcy. I think you're seeing that process starting to take place already. I do got to go to a break. I appreciate your call as always, Michael. We'll talk to another Michael from St. Paul and Kevin in Lakeville after this very short break. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
The Joe Pack
calls closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 1035 FM. Let's go to Michael from St. Paul. Welcome to the program. Michael.
Walter.
How you doing?
Let me see how I can put this. Absolutely better than you could possibly imagine in your wildest dreams.
Oh, I'm ready. Bring it on.
Because each and every single day is our own single day to make it better. And if things are wrong, I mean, we live in this physical realm of existence that isn't part of our higher self, of God, as you were talking about earlier. So, since we live here in this physical realm...
Right. And that's where we have to dump. Sorry.
He had me on the edge of my seat.
He really did. And like, then I became a listener to my own show.
Yep.
Like, I was not... I didn't even have something on the tip of my tongue. I was so enthralled by what Michael was saying and the direction he may go.
I think what he was trying to say is that maybe every day we have a chance to make things better.
You think? You
know? And maybe why stew in this negativity when things could be so great? I'm going to, you know, go out on a limb and hope that's kind of what he meant.
Yeah. Look, I appreciate the bar cadence, but you do have to keep the language under control here on the program.
Please
All
do.
Right, let's talk to Kevin in Lakeville. I'm sure he'll keep it clean for us.
Thanks for taking my call, Walter. Walter, you were talking about Germany.
Yeah.
When I watched on YouTube the flood of, I'm going to call them illegals because that's what they were, the problems that they created in Germany and throughout Europe were just unbelievable. Assaulting women, rape, violence, probably not assimilating very well. And they were also taking the properties from Germans and throwing them out or finding some other place for them.
Oh, okay. I take you at your word. Are you building up towards an application for domestic policy or just noting that this is the circumstance that Merkel has found herself in? What's the direction you see all this going? Let me put it that way.
I don't know if they can survive this. I know that I read that Austria had closed down the mosques and thrown them out. I know that Poland has very few, and they're not going to take them into their country.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that, and you can't open the borders to the U.S. through Mexico and flood us with people that are coming here illegally. We can't. Well, number one, we can't afford it. My question to you is, how many languages do they have in the L.A. school system?
I'm sure it's a cornucopia.
Yeah, you can't do it.
Yeah.
And the people that don't want to assimilate, no, I would have. They should have closed the borders a long time ago.
I understand where you're coming from, Kevin. I appreciate the call. We don't have enough time tonight to get into all the nuances of immigration policy. I am nonetheless fascinated by the goings-on over there in Europe. Let's talk to Barry in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
So I wonder if this whole move in the Democratic Party isn't a ruse to be able to stir up people, be able to cause unrest, like we saw with Black Lives Matter stuff, be able to try to push through laws that, because the Republicans are a law and order type, that they would go along with.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like what happened with 9/11. To further their ideas of getting ready for the Second Amendment and maybe First Amendment. And I go to this because I remember when they were having Black Lives Matter was having that sit-in or whatever you want to call it in Minneapolis around the 9th precinct that they were having problems
fourth.
With?
Yeah, fourth.
They were around the 4th precinct, and those two white guys went down there to figure out what was going on,
right.
Three of them. And they have permit to carry. They brought their guns with. I would have if I was them.
Well, unless it's a different group of guys than the one I'm thinking of, the group of guys... There was a group of guys, and I think it was three, who went down there, and they had guns, but they were rabble-rousers. They weren't innocents who were just trying to check things out.
I'm not saying they were innocent, but I'm not saying black people were innocent either.
Well, sure.
Well, which makes you question why... The only reason why they got in trouble like they did was because they had permits to carry the front guns for the fight. Instead of the other way around.
I would be with you on that suspicion, but having looked at the actual case, you know, when the convictions came down against those gentlemen, at least one of which I believe was a former police officer himself, it was clearly established that they went down there with the intent to cause trouble, and that they were motivated by very dark thoughts. But the underlying premise, though,
still makes sense. So why would they be stirring this pot if they weren't trying to get something out of it?
You talking about Black Lives Matter?
Well, no, just everything. With the Democrats, why are they stirring this pot if they aren't trying to get something out of it?
Well, they are trying to get something out of it, but what they're trying to get out of it is, I mean, they're telling us it's revolution. They want to overthrow the status quo.
And when that happens, when those people do that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, So it won't be the Democrat higher-ups. It will be the people on the ground, right?
Right.
So when they do that, they'll have plausible deniability to try to make laws against people doing that. That will take our rights away.
It's an interesting thought. Certainly, I think, and I appreciate the call, Barry, certainly I think we ought to be cognizant of the potential for solutions to modern problems to be turned around and used against us in a rights-violating manner in the future. That's something that we should always be aware of. We should always think about how the power that we grant a current administration could potentially be misused by a future one. That's something that the Democrats under the Obama administration never thought about. They never had any sort of reservation about the amount of power they cloaked Obama in. And now they're facing the consequences of that under Donald Trump in terms of him turning it around on them. And that's something we should be keeping in mind. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Twin Cities News.
So here's what we need to do. This will be a task for, Oh, man. This will be a task for Brad when he gets back. We need to get that clip of Donald Trump saying, ice. And then we need to hook up with our parody song producing company that we do business with here at iHeartMedia. And we need to redo Ice Ice Baby.
Yes.
Talking about immigration.
Yes. You got a new single on your hands, Walter.
Oh, my Lord. That
we
would
love
just,
ice. I can just see his hands right now. I mean, it makes me happy. I love ice, too. But
to hear it like that. Oh, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. The number to join us. Brianne, producing the show, taking your calls this evening. Let's talk to David in Woodbury. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. I'm just going to ask for you to clarify for me. My understanding is the last three presidential administrations, mm-hmm. when immigrants have come through the border, mm-hmm. their families potentially could get and were getting broken up, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And now Donald Trump issued an executive order mm-hmm. saying that's no longer going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm hearing Maxine Waters and including on normal quote-unquote news, them bringing this up again, like currently there's something being done badly that the executive order is supposed to have corrected. I guess what my observation is, and that's what I was asking you if I'm clear on that, is it seems like there's a lot of disinformation going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's coming from all sides, but it's primarily coming from the left. Surprise, surprise. The administration was being a little too cute by half when they tried to pretend as though the increase in separation of children from their parents at the border had nothing whatsoever to do with them. You know, it's true that it's a 1997 judicial decree that mandates that after 20 days of custody, children could no longer be kept by the government. And the rationale for that is pretty dang reasonable when you realize what it is. You know, the idea is the children aren't being charged with a crime, right? The parents are.
Right.
And so if you're going to continue to hold the parents for legal proceedings, it's unconstitutional. Surprise, surprise, to hold innocent people who aren't being charged with a crime. And so after 20 days, the argument was, well, we're going to send these kids, you know, to some sort of, you know, civilian protection. You know, they're not no longer going to be in law enforcement custody. And there's your separation, right?
Now, my understanding is also, though, is they were the immigration services or whatever were not mandated to keep any kind of records about who those children were.
Under the Obama administration, correct. In fact,
Only under Obama?
Well, I don't know. My sense was that, again, the particularly the Obama administration, there was kind of this wink, wink, nod, nod policy of, what children, right? Like they didn't want to keep records because they wanted to use that. And this is just my read on the situation, right? they wanted to use that as kind of a subversive workaround the immigration laws, right? To get the kids in here and then have the government conveniently forget where they went, you know, in order to not have any sort of follow-up from ICE.
So how do they claim that they being the government, care about the children when they weren't even keeping track of their names?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Doesn't that seem close?
Yeah. Appreciate the call, David. Yeah, I mean, look, you're not going to get any argument from me that the Democrats are hypocrites and that they don't actually care about the constituencies that they flaunt as being their own. And that, again, that's why we see the hashtag walk away movement on social media, because minority groups, you know, these constituencies, which have historically been Democratic bastions, are waking up slowly but surely on an individual basis. They're waking up to the fact that their would-be benefactors don't actually care about them at all. And, you know, the only thing that's amazing about that is that it's taken this long for people to start to realize. But hey, better late than never, and welcome to the real resistance against stupidity. From the New York Times, there's little that President Trump loves more than cementing his supporters' adoration of him while making his foes squirm. Nominating Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court would do both. She's not just a staunch conservative over whom Republicans and Democrats would wage a familiar fight. She's the prompt for an all-out culture war. I could almost see the president licking his chops. Appeals for the 7th District has emerged as a frontrunner for his seat. She was one of four finalists interviewed by Trump on Monday when CBS News, without specifying its source or sources, identified her as one of two leading contenders. The other was Brett Kavanaugh, a judge on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Many conservatives are lobbying ardently on her behalf. Ramesh Ponrara made a point-by-point case for her in a column for Bloomberg. Matthew Walther did the same in The Week. There's plenty more elsewhere, and to wade through it is to realize quickly that the push for Barrett isn't based solely on her credentials. It's also based on the kind of debate about her that conservatives prophesy. Barrett, you see, talks readily and proudly about her Catholicism, making no bones about its presence at the center of her life. She and her husband have 7 children, 2 of whom are adopted. She belongs to a mostly Catholic group, People of Praise, whose members make an especially intense commitment to their faith. And Republicans expect and want liberals to be so freaked out by this that they oppose her in a manner that could be branded anti-religious. They're setting her up to be a Christian martyr, minus the grisly end, and daring Democrats to take the bait. The Washington Post's Aaron Blake sagely sized up the appeal of this dynamic to Trump, writing that it's exactly the kind of battle he generally relishes, one that invites his opponents to overreach. My Times colleague Ross Douthat tweeted that if Trump wants to trigger the libs, he'll nominate Barrett. Douthat further predicted that her nomination might bring on the culture war apocalypse. She's the most tactically fascinating of the frontrunners in several ways. At 46, she's the youngest, so her time on the court could easily cover 4 decades. She's a longtime resident of Indiana, which happens to be home to Joe Donnelly, one of 3 Democratic senators whose votes are most clearly in play when it comes to confirming Trump's nominee. Trump won Indiana handily in 2016, and Donnelly is up for re-election in November. He'd be nervous about blocking any of the president's picks for the court. He might be doubly nervous about blocking Barrett. In terms of experience, she'd be an atypical nominee. She'd be the only justice on the Supreme Court without an impromptu of the Ivy League, and there's little whiff of the coastal elites about her. She did her undergraduate work at Rhodes College in Tennessee and then attended law school at Notre Dame, where she subsequently taught for more than a decade up until her appointment to the circuit court last year. Isn't it amazing that somebody who, you know, went did undergraduate work and, you know, taught at Notre Dame, like, that's not classy enough, apparently, to qualify as an elitist? Like, yeah, Notre Dame, oh.
How common.
Yeah, right.
Ugh. I'm disgusted.
But that's where we find ourselves. Look, the libs, this is obviously written by a lefty, this article at the New York Times, and the Democrats are nervous about Trump setting this trap, and they should be, because the left will fall for it. They will fall for it because that's who they are. And in doing so, they're going to betray their religious hypocrisy, because one of the biggest arguments against Donald Trump during the 2016 election was that, oh my God, he's putting up a religious test for immigration. He's putting up a religious test for, you know, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I believe there was a particular appointment where he had said that, or maybe it was some other candidate, had said something along the lines of, I think it was Bob Carson. Or is that the right name? Bob Carson? No, that's not right.
Ben Carson?
Ben Carson. Thank you. Ben Carson had said something along the lines of, it wouldn't be appropriate for a Muslim to hold office under the United States Constitution or something along those lines. And then he became part of the Trump administration. And so they tried to make this argument that the Trump administration is putting forward religious tests for public service. Well, listen, you put up a Catholic, and the key here is faithful Catholic, believing, somebody who takes their religion seriously, which, you know, I know is crazy, but like I said earlier in the show, I don't understand the point of identifying with a particular religion if you don't take it seriously. It's just ridiculous.
What's like, the point?
Why even claim it if you don't actually believe it and think it has meaningful impact upon your life and that you ought to take it seriously? But regardless, for her to be nominated and for the left to jump on her and say that because she's a faithful Catholic, she shouldn't qualify to be the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States will just rend open and bear for all to see the fact that they actually do believe in religious tests. It just so happens that the only religion they're concerned with excluding is Christianity. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So there was an interesting poll that came out earlier this week or late last week. Not exactly sure when. A poll that was done by this outfit called Outstate.us. Now, this group has popped up before. You know, they made some headlines when, you know, they came out and basically advocated against the caucus and convention process within the Republican Party. And, you know, the case is that all of the delegates who show up to endorse candidates for office at these party conventions are party insiders, right? And that they're part of the establishment. And so the decision as to who ought to represent us shouldn't be left to such muckety mucks and movers and shakers within the party establishment, that this is the proverbial smoky back room, which let's just pause to explore how ludicrous that concept is, right? Like here's how somebody becomes a delegate to a convention. They attend caucus in their own neighborhood, along with people who they live next to during caucuses, and they get elected by their neighbors to be delegates to their local party convention. And then they go to that local party convention where they're joined by neighbors from a broader geographic area who share their values, and they run to be delegates to the congressional district and the state conventions. And it goes on up like that. Now, that's called a grassroots process. And the people who do that are not the, you know, the movers and shakers and the muckety mucks. They're normal, average folks like yours truly. You know, a lot of them blue collar, and a lot of them who are making a big sacrifice to spend up to $100-$150. You know, it's often when you're talking about a state convention that you have to travel across the state to get to, like, you know, Duluth they had this year and the last time as well, I believe. That's quite an expense for somebody who, you know, is potentially taking a couple of days off work, traveling across the state, booking a couple of nights a hotel, having to pay for meals, you know, and then the effort that goes into it. It's not a small amount of sacrifice. So the idea that that process ought to produce something that's meaningful in the form of the endorsement is an argument that's not without merit. Now, be that as it may, if you want to make the case that, you know, there ought to be a broader sampling of the Republican electorate as to who the candidate ought to be, there are meritorious ways to make that argument, but crafting the convention process as a bunch of, you know, muckety-muck insiders who, you know, are the denizens of smoky back rooms is a disingenuous way to go about that. But nonetheless, this same group, Outstate, conducted this poll, and they had some pretty interesting results. You know, they indicate that it's a poll of likely Minnesota voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5%, 95% confidence level conducted by Interactive Voice Response. So a legitimate scientific poll. The first question they asked was, which of the following issues should elected officials make their top priority? And the winner, by a long shot, was jobs and the economy. Now, this doesn't surprise me at all. You know, this is something that has been, well, it's manifest in the urban-rural divide that we're seeing, right? We talked about the map that Javier Murillo, friend of the show, you know, SEIU guy, who you can hear on Wrong About Everything, the map that he tweeted out recently that shows the difference between 2012 and 2016 in terms of the county-by-county breakdown of red and blue. And the blue is becoming much more concentrated here in the state of Minnesota, which indicates this growing rural-urban divide. That is a real distinction, and it is informed almost entirely by jobs in the economy. Because people outstate, you know, need to be able to work in order to live, and their options are relatively limited compared to people who live, you know, in the urban areas where there are much more choices in terms of occupation. And when they're being told, yeah, your mining job that you depend upon in order to pay your mortgage, that's got to go away because somebody who lives on the other side of the state in a big city doesn't want to pollute your water that they don't drink. Not a very compelling argument. And so, you know, the Democrats find themselves in rough shape on that. The second issue in terms of being ranked as a top priority was immigration, which I suppose we shouldn't be all that surprised about. They went on to ask about whether or not you would your elected officials should act as a check on Donald Trump to prevent him from enacting his agenda, or stand with the president to push his agenda, or prioritize local issues and focus on getting results for your community. 41% wanted to have a check on Trump, 37% wanted support for Trump, and 18% wanted to prioritize local issues. And the rest of these questions kind of break down along similar fashions. You would gather from that response that the 41% is primarily Democrats, the 37% is primarily Republicans. And as you go down the list here, they ask, you know, for the generic Senate candidate, would you vote Republican or Democrat? It's 42 to 49. 42% would vote Republican, 49 would vote for Democrat. In terms of the governor's race, very similar, 42% Republican, 48% Democrat. So there remains this kind of default generic preference or favor for the Democrats in this state. But, you know, within the margin of error, the margin isn't that huge. It's certainly not insurmountable in terms of what Republicans can potentially do in order to make this thing go down. And as you start to put meat on these bones, as we get closer and closer to the general election, as we get past the primary and the faces are put to the names and the issues are put to those faces and those names, it's going to be very clear that we're dealing with, you know, certainly if Aaron Murphy somehow ends up becoming the candidate on the general election ballot, you're dealing with one of the most metro, one of the most progressive and completely out of sync with the mainstream candidacies that the Democrats have put up within years, next to either Jeff Johnson or probably more likely Tim Pawlenty. And that's going to be a very clear choice. Closing argument. Have a good 4th of July, 9 to 11 weeknights, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Thanks for listening to